for, but most of the indirect detection signals people look for come from our own galaxy. So here's a cartoon. I'll draw it better in a few minutes, but our galaxy is a flat disk, and we're rotating along with the disk. And this disk is surrounded by a big dark matter halo. And every so often, a couple of dark matter particles in the halo can come together and annihilate with each other. And when they annihilate, they'll produce some kind of annihilation products. And these annihilation products have characteristic energies on the order of the dark matter masses. This is the amount of energy going into the reaction. And these decay products can potentially, they might diffuse around and propagate in some funny way from where the annihilation happens, and they might end up to us. And what we see at the end of the day are high-energy particles coming from space. So we already see high-energy particles, and we expect them from astrophysics, and we call them cosmic rays. And the point is that dark matter annihilation can also produce cosmic rays on top of just what you get from astrophysics. So again, it's chi-chi, goes to standard model, annihilation process. And one thing I want to point out is that, just last week or week before, we looked at thermal freeze-out of dark matter. And you might be wondering, okay, if dark matter has frozen out, dark matter freezing out means that it's not annihilating very, very much at all. Why do I expect the annihilation here? And the answer is that if I look in a galactic halo, the galactic halo represents an overdense region of dark matter. So the idea is you started off with a very, very smooth cosmological density. And for example, around the time of recombination, your density fluctuations were something like 1 part in 10 to the minus 5. So you start with a very, very uniform universe. But as you spoke about in the first week, these fluctuations collapse on themselves gravitationally, and they start clumping together. And in fact, in the case of a galactic dark matter halo, they start self-gravitating. And the point is that the density of dark matter within a halo is much, much larger than the mean cosmological density. So the point is we started off with a very, very smooth, uniform, and not very dense distribution of dark matter. And in patches, this very flat distribution has collapsed into more dense regions. And in these more dense regions, the cross-section can come up enough for annihilation to be at least somewhat significant.
Yeah. Do we expect the dark matter halo to collapse further in size, or do you have any data?
So the point is that the dark matter annihilates enough that we could potentially see it, but not so much as to affect the properties of the halo itself. So the annihilation is not happening, at least typically, it's not happening so fast that the halo is disappearing or collapsing. So it should be a fairly steady state picture. And it turns out that in most of the cases, it takes a long time for the annihilation products from the dark matter to get from wherever the annihilation happened all the way to us. And that means that even if my initial standard model products are some kind of elementary particle, we're going to be interested in the stable particles that these things ultimately decay into. So in general, the standard model stuff could be stuff like quarks or anti-quarks, or electrons or anti-electrons, or V plus, V minus, tau plus, tau minus, W plus, W minus, Z naught, I guess even Higgs, or neutrino or antineutrino or photons. But many of these particles are not stable. And because it typically takes a long time for the annihilation product of the dark matter to get to us, if a particle is unstable, it will generically have decayed into whatever its stable final states are at the end of the day before the stuff actually gets to us. So what we really look for, what we actually expect to see in our detectors, are the stable species of the standard model. So a proton or antiproton, an electron or positron, a neutrino or antineutrino, or a photon. So these are the stable species within the standard model. Okay, and the point is that these stable species are what we look for in terms of cosmic rays. In cosmic rays, sometimes we also look for heavy nuclei. So typically, the initial annihilation doesn't really produce many heavy nuclei. You might get a bit of deuterium, but you can also have effects like protons hitting nuclei already in the interstellar medium, or in the galactic halo, and accelerating them or transforming them into something else. But for the most part, we look at these elementary particles as cosmic rays. Okay, so to actually compute, so let me just draw a diagram, chi goes to standard model. So to actually compute this signal, we have to do a bunch of stuff. And some of the stuff we do is particle physics, and some of the stuff we do is astrophysics. And one of the complications of this game, of looking for dark matter indirectly, is figuring out the astrophysics. Because it turns out that there are lots of astrophysical uncertainties that can make your life difficult. Okay, so okay. Well, the first step, of course, is to figure out the rate of dark matter light annihilation. And fortunately, this is something you people all know how to do now. So this isn't too bad. The second thing, though, is that it turns out that we're going to be very interested not in just the total number of events, but in the energy spectrum of them. So we also have to figure out the final energy spectrum. Of the products of the dark matter annihilation. So for example, let's say my dark matter annihilates into W plus W minus. In terms of the W plus W minus that I annihilate to initially, what do those W plus W minus produce in terms of these stable particles at the end of the day? So there's a reprocessing step, and that's the second piece. The third one is we need to figure out or model the propagation of the dark matter induced cosmic rays. So I'll write them just as a DNCR. We also have to do the same for the astrophysical sources of cosmic rays. So write those as astro CRs. And well, the last one, okay, I guess as theorists, we don't do this directly, but we need to measure signals. So if I look at the stuff here, this stuff is generally counted as astrophysics, and this stuff is generally counted as particle physics. So one of the things you run into in this game of indirect detection is it's really working at the interface of particle physics and astrophysics. I guess particle astrophysics, if you will. Okay. Okay. So in terms of these annihilation products, these stable final these stable endpoint states that we get from the dark matter annihilation. The stuff that we usually look well, the stuff we usually look for in experiments are protons, antiprotons, electrons, positrons, and photons. Not so much neutrinos, just because the neutrinos are harder to detect. So that's the first thing. And often the proton, antiproton, E plus, E minus, but sometimes also called, sometimes when people say cosmic rays, they mean these specifically. And the photons are, well, they can be gamma rays or X-rays or radio frequency. And you can look for these photons produced by dark matter annihilation in these various different frequency bands using different kinds of detectors. So it turns out that photons are relatively simple in how they get from the annihilation to us. A decent fraction of the time, we just see the primary gamma ray directly from the annihilation. But you can also have interesting stuff happen, like you can have a photon, you can have a high energy photon Compton scatter, and that reduces its energy, and you have various propagation effects. But with photons, for the most part, they tend to go in straight lines, and you can take your telescope and point it at the source and see what's going on. On the other hand, for these cosmic rays, and by that I mean specifically protons, antiprotons, electrons, and positrons, life is more complicated. The propagation from the source, the annihilation to us, is there's a whole industry in predicting it. It's non-trivial, and I'm going to try to give you an outline of it. But I'm not an expert in it, so I'm not going to go into too much depth. But what a lot of people in the field do, I guess for good or for ill, is there's some very standard computational packages to compute cosmic ray propagation. And at the very least, I hope to give you enough background to at least understand the general idea behind these numerical packages. And also, if you're reading papers on dark matter direct detection, to at least have a familiarity with the terms people use. And if this is something you're interested in, I mean, go ahead and study in more detail. I'm just going to try to give you a quick outline. Okay, so where shall I start? Okay, well, the first place I'll start is, I guess, the first place I'll start is the injection spectrum. And what I mean by the injection spectrum is just the energy spectrum of the particles produced by the dark matter annihilation. Okay, so how will I write it? I'll write this as qi of x and e. And what I mean by this is, so the rate of ejection or the rate of production of the ith species per unit volume per unit energy. So in other words, this qi is, suppose I corresponds to positrons. This gives me, this corresponds to the rate at which I produce positrons per unit volume with the given energy E. So it's, if you like, it's a differential quantity depending on the energy. And it's standard to write this as follows. This is going to be essentially the local dark matter density at the injection point, or sorry, I should say the number density, which is just the energy density at point x divided by the number density squared times the annihilation cross-section. So I'm going to write this as the total annihilation cross-section times the branching fraction to I times the spectrum. So, well, this first piece is straightforward. This is just the number density of the dark matter species at at the annihilation point, at the point x where it's annihilating. This is the total annihilation cross section. So that corresponds to my probability of two dark matter particles annihilating. This BR is the branching ratio. And what I mean by branching ratio is the fraction of the time the annihilation produces this ith final state.
So you may have already mentioned this, but why do we have a square on the first row
for
n?
Well, the square corresponds to the fact that you have you need two dark matter particles to come together. So if you remember our equation for thermal freezeout, we had n dot plus 3hn. So for thermal freezeout, we had plus 3hn minus sigma v n chi squared minus n chi eq squared. So so the square just comes from the fact that we have two particles coming in. So branching ratios, you probably encounter those in your particle physics or QFT course. So it's just a fraction of the time the annihilation produces the ith species. And finally, this dn I dE, so this qi is a differential quantity in that it corresponds to the fraction of the time that you annihilate to the specific energy E. But in general, you're going to have a continuous spectrum. So to make it differential, you take the total cross section and you multiply by this dn I dE factor. And this is the This is the energy spectrum of the ith particle per annihilation. So just to give you an example of this, suppose for example, I have chi chi goes to W plus W minus, and my W minus goes to some fraction of the time to nu bar E minus, and some other fraction of the time it can go to nu bar mu minus, and this nu mu later goes to nu mu nu bar E minus. So because there are different ways to get this final electron out of this decay, if I look at the dn dE as a function of E, I'm going to have some spectrum. And this factor just takes into account that part. Okay, so this is our injection, and this means that we inject the source of cosmic rays at point X in the galactic halo with energy E. So again, to draw my cartoon, we're somewhere here in the galactic disk, and you have a dark matter annihilation here at point X, and so far this just corresponds to the rate at which I'm producing the cosmic ray injection at this point, x. So my next step, of course, is going to be to figure out how likely it is for this thing at x to propagate and get to us down here. Okay. So far, I told you about how you get you can get cosmic rays from dark matter. It turns out, we also expect lots of cosmic rays from astrophysics. So cosmic rays from astrophysics, the main source is thought to be a supernova. So supernova are exploding stars. And what happens in a supernova is that a star gets, if you start with a big enough star and it gets old enough, it uses up all of its fuel. And I guess the way stars work, you probably know this, but the way stars work is that the gravitational interaction of everything in the star is counteracted by the thermal pressure holding it out. And the thermal pressure is produced by the heat created by nuclear reactions. Eventually in stars, once they get big enough, once their core goes to iron, the nuclear reactions stop. And when the nuclear reactions stop, the star can no longer support itself against gravitational collapse. And the star collapses on itself. And what happens is when everything gets to a small enough size, you have a rebound, either because you reach the electron degeneracy pressure or neutron degeneracy pressure. But you have a rebound, and the rebound blows a whole bunch of stuff out. And this gives you a big explosion. That's your supernova. And as the shell of the star is being blown out, you get shock fronts. And these shock fronts accelerate lots of particles around you. So the picture for cosmic rays from astrophysics are they come from the acceleration of particles by supernova. Shockwaves. Okay. And it turns out that if you average over the supernova in our galaxy, the energy spectrum of cosmic rays comes out. Or the estimates give you a power law. And so in other words, the total flux, phi of E, of cosmic rays with energy E, is proportional to E to some power. And this power is, I think, kind of free-ish. But the important thing is that for these astrophysical cosmic rays, the flux from these cosmic rays, the energy spectrum, is a smoothly following is a smooth power law following function. So this actually helps us, and this helps us because we want to distinguish cosmic rays from dark matter, from astrophysical cosmic rays. So this helps us for two reasons. The first reason is cosmic rays from DM typically have a more interesting spectrum. So suppose I draw an energy spectrum of cosmic rays. So here's my cosmic ray flux as a function of energy. And this is the cosmic ray flux that we see. And this flux is going to be this injection spectrum convolved with a transfer function that tells us how the cosmic rays get from their production point to us. The helpful thing here is that for astrophysics, actually, I should get some colorful chalk for this. The nice thing is that from astrophysics, astrophysical cosmic rays are just some following power law. Whereas for dark matter annihilation, we have a characteristic energy scale. For dark matter annihilation, we have a characteristic energy scale associated with the annihilation given by the dark matter mass. So if this is my dark matter mass, the spectrum of cosmic rays from dark matter is going to be something more like this. So this is what I get from astro. This is what I get from dark matter. So the technique, or one technique that's very helpful for distinguishing dark matter cosmic rays from astrophysical cosmic rays is the flux spectrum. So this is the first thing that helps. The second thing that helps is that dark matter, as we know, has to be electrically neutral. And the upshot of dark matter being electrically neutral is that if I look at the stuff that dark matter produces, protons or antiprotons or electrons or antielectrons, from dark matter annihilation, I should have just as many protons as antiprotons or electrons from as antielectrons, up to possibly some propagation effects. On the other hand, for astrophysical cosmic rays, most of the stuff that you get from the astrophysical cosmic rays is going to be will be matter, not antimatter. So from astrophysical cosmic rays, you can still get positrons or antiprotons, but typically these positrons or antiprotons are secondaries. And what I mean by that is, again, this is just terminology. A primary is a particle produced directly, either from dark matter annihilation or the supernova or a supernova shock front, and a secondary. And sometimes people also talk about tertiaries, is a particle produced when a primary particle hits something floating around in its way and creates new particles. So for example, suppose I have a primary proton. A high energy primary proton could run into a heavy nucleus or another proton floating around the interstellar medium or the vicinity of the galaxy. And I could have proton-proton goes to proton-proton plus proton-proton plus two antiprotons, for example. So a primary collision can produce antiprotons and vice versa. But the point is that because dark matter is neutral, its primaries will have just as many positrons as electrons, antiprotons as protons. Whereas for the cosmic rays from astrophysical sources, typically your primaries are just about all matter, not antimatter. So only the secondaries from astrophysics give you antiparticles. And that means that the two tricks to distinguish cosmic ray dark matter, dark matter cosmic rays from astrophysical cosmic rays, is for first of all you look at the energy spectrum, and second of all you look at the ratio of matter of antimatter to matter. So these are the two tricks. Okay, so this is the big overview. Let me next get to say a few words about how we actually estimate how these cosmic rays go from where they're produced to us, where we actually detect them. Okay, so cosmic ray propagation. Okay, so it turns out that to describe the propagation of cosmic rays, we use what is essentially a diffusion equation. So I guess you probably encountered diffusion equations at some point in your undergraduate careers or in the mathematical physics courses here. But a diffusion equation is essentially that the time derivative of a number density is equal to the square of its gradient. So grad square density. And what this describes is regions with large values of grad squared correspond to high densities, and these tend to spread out over time. In the case of cosmic rays, we have a similar thing. You start with if you start with a high number density, this high number density, it turns out, is going to bounce off irregularities in the interstellar interstellar magnetic fields. And these small irregularities mean that for protons or electrons, they're going to bounce around a whole lot before they get to us. So this bouncing around, on average, ends up looking like diffusion. On top of that, you have other effects. You have, because you have supernova going off in the galactic plane, this ends up generating a net wind of hot gas away from the galactic plane. So you have a convection effect, where your dark matter can be carried along by these convection currents. You can also have dark matter colliding with stuff. And as dark matter collides with stuff, this will change, sorry, not dark matter. You can have the dark matter cosmic rays collide with stuff. So these protons or antiprotons or electrons or positrons. And these collisions can either destroy the product entirely or change its energy spectrum. And I think I've got most of the effects there. But in any case, let me draw a big picture let me draw the big picture that usually comes up when people talk about cosmic ray propagation. So this big picture is our galaxy with the halo around it drawn from the side view. So you're looking at the disk head on. And the picture is this flat thing is our galactic disk. It's not entirely flat. It has a thickness of about 100 parsecs, or if you like, 0.1 kiloparsec. And this disk is surrounded by a big halo of dark matter. And finally, for the to look at cosmic ray propagation, the way it's usually treated is you assume that there's a zone surrounding the disk in which the cosmic rays obey the diffusion equation. But to make your life easier, you assume that this diffusion region is finite in size, and outside that region, you just treat the cosmic rays or the cosmic ray products as propagating freely. So put another way, you have a diffusion region. And I'm drawing this from the side, but we should take this diffusion region to be a cylinder. So I'll draw it this way. Cylinder, and this little thing here, I should draw it with some very small spatial thickness, so it's not entirely flat. This is the galactic plane. So for the dark matter halo, we describe it in the usual way. We have some local dark matter density, rho chi of x. And for this, this will be, let's say, an NFW profile or isothermal profile or anasto or something like that. But it's just some dark matter profile that you guys have encountered. Here is, I'll try to get the symmetry right. Here's the center of the galaxy. So the galactic disk is rotating around this. And we're sitting out some distance from, I'll draw it yellow for the sun. We're sitting out at some distance from the center of the galaxy. And this distance is roughly 8.5 kiloparsecs. And in terms of treating this diffusion zone, the width is typically taken to be about the extent of the visible stuff in the Milky Way, which is, how shall I draw that? Okay, I'll call this radius R. And this diffusion region, you also give it a height, and you call that L. So typical values are, I'll write them over here. This height parameter is fairly uncertain, but it's typically taken to be in the range of 3 to 12 kiloparsecs. And this radius is about 20 kiloparsecs. So we're kind of roughly equidistant from the center of the galaxy in the size of the diffusion zone. Okay, so in terms of the injection, this injection spectrum applies all over the halo. So your dark matter can be injecting cosmic rays, well, in any side, in anywhere inside in this big sphere, which technically goes to infinity, but the density falls off. But once the cosmic ray is injected, once it gets into this region, and for the most part, we'll only care about cosmic rays injected within this region, the cosmic rays are going to bounce around through the diffusion effect until they reach us. And let me draw one more thing. The other thing is there's a net convection. So I'll write this as VC. And this net convection corresponds to the fact that stuff in the galactic plane, some of the stuff in the galactic plane are supernova. And these supernova are ejecting material out. And the net effect of that are convection currents going out this way and that. And this can affect the propagation of cosmic rays as well. Okay, so to describe cosmic ray propagation, I'm going to use a variable called psi I. And this psi I corresponds to the local number density of the ice species, unit energy, which depends on T, X, and E. So psi I is the local number density of the ice cosmic ray species from all the injection. And and we have some diffusion equation to describe this. And to simplify the diffusion equation, and this is a reasonable approximation, we assume that the system has reached a steady state. So diffusion equations naturally have a time-dependent piece. So the time-dependent piece would be a ddt of this. We assume that the ddt of this is zero because the system's reached a steady state, which should be a reasonable approximation. So in a steady state, what you find what you get for the diffusion equation has the following form. The rate of injection at a given point for the ice species is going to be, how do I want this? Well, I'll write this. Let me write out these terms, and then I'll try to explain them. Okay, so this is our diffusion equation written in a steady state. So this first piece, of course, is just the source. So this is the source of cosmic rays, either from astrophysics or dark matter. This first piece, this grad squared, is what you would get from diffusion. So this is what I'm going to call spatial diffusion. And the reason for the spatial diffusion, as I mentioned before, is the fact that in this interstellar medium, you have they're very small magnetic fields. And in these magnetic fields, you have little irregularities. And these little irregularities, if you take a charged particle, will lead to scattering. So the sort of randomized irregularity, the net effect is encompassed, and the size of the fields are encompassed in this diffusion coefficient. But the point is that if I inject a cosmic ray at some source with some energy, it's going to bounce off and be reflected, and it's not just going to go in a straight line. So that gives me diffusion. The second piece is energy loss. So for example, for example, my cosmic ray particle could scatter off something else and lose energy that way. Or I could even lose density in the cosmic ray particle if it hits if it runs into something and changes into something else entirely. So I have a loss term. This piece corresponds to, in a sense, diffusion in momentum space. And this last piece corresponds to convection. So convection from this net wind of junk coming off the galactic plane.
So what is B? B loss.
It's a diffusion coefficient. So it's just some coefficient that describes how much you're losing.
Okay.
And I should also mention that this VC is roughly 15 to 100 kilometers per second times z hat times the sine of z. So all I mean by z hat sine of z is that above the plane it points up, and below the plane it points down. So the sine of z just gets the direction right. Okay, I think this is mostly most of what I wanted to say. But the upshot is that the process of cosmic ray propagation is very complicated. You typically describe it using a diffusion equation of that form. One challenge that you run into is that there are lots of uncertainties in the corresponding coefficients that go into the equation. So beyond the fact that it might not be entirely a good approximation to even use the diffusion equation to describe this propagation, that's already an approximation. You also have other questions from what geometry should I use from the diffusion zone. So this diffusion equation applies specifically within this diffusion zone. Outside the diffusion zone, the cosmic rays are just allowed to travel freely. So that's another uncertainty. The thing you know usually pretty well is this source. But at the end of the day, this is just a very difficult question, and you do the best you can. And pull this down. Okay. For those of you who got in a bit late, let me mention that my equation 29 in the second note has a typo. There should be no m chi factor in the denominator. I've updated the note and I've reposted it. Just wanted to let people know. Okay. In any case, so cosmic ray propagation is complicated and difficult. There's a standard tool that people in the field use to compute this, and this is a program called Galprop. And it's by Moskalenko and Strong. So for the most part, people don't actually go off and solve the diffusion equations themselves. They use this tool. And one nice thing this tool has built into it is that even though there are lots of uncertainties for this, at least on the astrophysical side, where we expect astrophysical cosmic rays, there are certain consistency cross-checks you can apply to help you nail down the coefficients that go into this equation. And one very important consistency check is if you look at primarily astrophysical cosmic rays, you look at the ratio of boron cosmic rays to carbon, so the B over C ratio. And it turns out that this is useful for a number of reasons. But the main idea is that boron, or let me start with carbon. The reason this is useful is carbon most of the carbon cosmic rays, and again, these are carbon nuclei produced by supernova or accelerated by supernova shocks, is mostly most of the carbon you see is primary. In the sense that carbon is one of the elements that stars make in a relatively large amount. And because stars make it fairly efficiently, when the star explodes, you get a good amount of carbon cosmic rays coming out. So your carbon cosmic rays are mostly primaries. On the other hand, the boron, is only produces secondary. So this is useful, for example, because for instance, it helps you fix things like the energy loss term. It helps you fix things like the energy loss term. We have a pretty good estimate for how much total flux we should be getting from supernova in our galaxy. So this boron over carbon ratio turns out to be an important cross-check for these. And Galprop is nice because it takes these constraints into account. And it deals with them all consistently. And even with these constraints, and there are other heavy element constraints you can apply, even with these constraints, there's still significant uncertainties. But one way these are parameterized, and I'm not going to go into the details of what goes into these parameterizations, but it'll be helpful for reading papers for you to know about them, is there are three popular models that give you at least an idea of what the astrophysical uncertainty is on cosmic ray propagation. So model is a bit strong in that for all of these, we're assuming a diffusion equation of that form. The difference where these models differ, the place where these models differ, is in what specific parameter values you use. So there's the so-called medium, or med. And in some sense, this is sort of a best fit model to the data, based on astrophysical data. And then in addition to the med, you have so-called min and max models. And these are, if you like, worst, best, so what I mean by min or max is, in some sense, this is the worst case or best case scenario for how likely you are to see antiprotons from dark matter annihilation. And by min or max, it corresponds to how far you can push things while still being self-consistent with things like boron to carbon ratios and so on. So for example, if I look at the flux, if I look at, let's say I was to look at antiproton flux as a function of energy, and suppose that this is exclusive from dark matter, I could plot three curves corresponding to these different propagation spectra. The middle one would be med, and the upper one would be, so this middle one would be my med. This would be my max. That would be my min. So the actual flux we see at the end of the day is going to depend on the propagation. And there'll be some band that's consistent with the data. So the actual parameters in these models don't matter so much. But very often, if you read a paper about where someone predicts a dark matter signal from cosmic rays, they'll look at these three models. So it's useful to know what they are. Okay, so now one way to write the solution of these diffusion equations. Oh, I missed a spot. One way to write the solution of these diffusion equations is we want to take the injection spectrum all over the halo and integrate over the halo and find the local flux. So the local flux is going to be related to this value of psi. So this is our position. So we want to know what the cosmic ray flux is where we are as a function of energy that we see. And this quantity I'll explain what's going into this in a second. Okay, so this thing is going to be basically the flux where we are. It's not quite the flux. It's a local density, and we'll turn it into a flux in a second. And to get the net flux where we are, what we have is we look at the injection, and we integrate the injection over all the places in the galaxy where dark matter could be. And we also integrate over all the possible injection energies, or so-called source energy. So the idea is that we integrate over all the possible sources with a transfer function that tells us how a source at position x source, e source, gives us a transfer to our position with some possibly different energy e that we actually see. So the energy that the cosmic ray has at the source might not be the same as the cosmic ray energy that we see. And that's what this transfer function, or if you like this Green's function, encapsulates. And this Green's function is the output of the diffusion equation. And finally, what we want to write at the end of the day is a flux of the ith particle. And this flux is, again, the flux where we are as a function of energy. It's the flux we see. And this flux is just, I take this number density, I multiply it by the velocity corresponding to the given energy of the particle, and then I multiply by psi. Yes?
Does this have any time dependence? Or?
Yeah, well, so here we've implicitly assumed a steady state.
Yeah, but...
And the same should go through here. So we assume that the galaxy is relaxed to a steady state where there's just some net flux that doesn't change with time. There's one place, I might not come up, but it turns out that the magnetic field, the magnetic activity of the sun can actually deflect some cosmic rays. So you can get a little bit of time dependence from that. But ignoring that for the time being, it's only really relevant for lower energy cosmic rays. We expect a time independent steady state effect. OK, and the typical units of flux are the number per cubic meter, per centimeter, per inverse GeV, per steradian. So a steradian is just a unit of solid angle where the whole circle is 4 pi. So this is the flux we see. The dividing by 4 pi gives us the steradian part. OK, so at this point, we would like to write this in as much as possible, in as far as we can. I'll finish in a second, and separate astrophysics from particle physics. So very often, one popular way to do this is to rewrite these equations. This is a fairly trivial rewriting in this form. An F times integral dEES, F of ES, I of ES. So this F, if you go back and look at my equation for the source, it's just to be a V over 8 pi. Sigma V, and we normalize it to the local dark matter density. This F of ES is the spectrum. I think I erased it, but the F of ES is the dN. It's just the dN dE. And this I is a transfer function, and this transfer function is, I just factor off the source integral with my Green's function as appropriate. And in this, I put the dark matter density at the source divided by the solar density squared. And I think I have all the factors. So this piece is basically particle physics. This piece is basically particle physics. And all the astrophysics has been lumped into here. So this astrophysics has the dark matter density at the source location and the propagation part. So it's nice to factor out this piece and to have a uniform form for that. OK, so I'm out of time, but I'll keep on going tomorrow. And I'll get specifically to signals and positrons and antiprotons. And there's an interesting, fun story in that in the case of positrons, there seems to be more signal than we expect, at least from astrophysics, at least from naive astrophysics. So there's been a lot of interest in this so-called positron excess. We still don't fully understand it, but it's an exciting thing in the field of dark matter.